Hello, everyone. Welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, the podcast where we delve into the heart of hospice palliative care. My name is Lori Gill, and I am the education specialist at North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, and I will be your host today as we explore the topic of palliative approach to care with a focus on Indigenous population. Before I introduce our guest today, I'd like to start by acknowledging the land we live upon. As visitors on this land, we have an important responsibility to acknowledge the grounds on which we are privileged to gather and to honor the Indigenous peoples who are the original stewards of these lands upon which we were all visitors each and every day. Today, we are gathered in the city of Orillia, which is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. As I reflect upon the traditional territories I have been privileged to reside upon throughout my life, I am reminded to show gratitude for this beautiful place I get to call home. When I think of home, I think of the things I love to do with my family, such as camping and hiking on the trails near our home, which always reminds me of the healing power of nature. This is a home that I can safely walk hand in hand with my children on, one that we ski upon in the winter and play upon in the summer. I'd like to give thanks to the local First Peoples for welcoming us in their homelands to be able to do all of the things we love. Acknowledgements are but one step forward towards standing up and standing with Indigenous peoples, allowing us to begin to open the door for more understanding. Growing up, land acknowledgements and showing gratitude to Indigenous peoples for welcoming us into their homelands was certainly not a part of my childhood, or school learnings, or dinner conversations. Now, as a parent of three children, I want to share my commitment to ongoing awareness and learning alongside my children. I want to continue to learn together about not only the historical Indigenous struggles and the reality of Indigenous people's treatment, but the struggles faced today as they continue to persist. The end result can only be a better and brighter future for everyone who call Indigenous lands home, and I encourage you all to do the same. So today with us are two remarkable guests who bring valuable perspectives to our discussion. Kathleen Bartlett, who is a palliative pain and symptom management consultant, and her guest, Joanna Vautour, who is an Anishinaabe band member of Serpent River First Nation. Joanna has 25 years of social work experience. In the last 10 years, she has been working in palliative care. She holds several roles in palliative care education and research and Indigenous social work education. Her social work experience involves the health and well-being of individuals and families in all life stages in the Toronto Indigenous community and throughout Ontario. Join us as we create a safe place to share, reflect, and connect, honoring the diverse perspectives of those impacted by this deeply human experience. Whether you're directly involved or simply seeking understanding, we invite you to journey with us into the heart of love, loss, and the choices that define our lives. Thank you both for joining us today.
Lori, I loved your land acknowledgement. That was so
Thank
heartfelt. I really appreciate
you.
it.
Thanks.
So, I'm Kathleen Bartlett. I'm a registered nurse, palliative pain and symptom management consultant with the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. And thank you so much, Joanna, for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation to be on this podcast. Thank you so much for that introduction. But I would also like to introduce myself in my language. Bonjour, Ninabwit Gija Kwe Nadishnakaz, Mishkan Dodem, Ganabajing, Donjaba, Anishinaabe Kwe Nindau. And so what I shared with you is my spirit name. It's Standing Cedar, and I am of the Turtle Clan, and I live in Serpent River First Nation. Some will refer to it in the language as Ganabajing or Cheekanabeg-Sibbing. I wanted to share that with all of you. And what I'm going to share with you today is from my lived experience as Anishinaabe Kwe woman, and that, I cannot speak for other nations' teachings or other communities. I can only share from what I know from my lived experience being from Serpent River First Nation.
Joanna. So we just heard Lori's land acknowledgement, which was super personal. She added her own touches to it. But what do you think of land acknowledgements? We're hearing a lot of the importance of companies, peoples, including these land acknowledgements within their companies, on emails, etc. But we're also wanting to make sure that we're creating these and that they're meaningful. So can you kind of give us your take on land acknowledgments?
Thank you for asking this question. We are seeing more land acknowledgments being done in a lot of our spaces in the work that we do. And often we see a scripted statement that recognizes the land and its original people of the land. And we see them in email signatures and on organization websites, and they're offered before gatherings. What is missing from land acknowledgments is that the individual acknowledging the land lacks knowledge of Indigenous people's history, culture, and present state. And what land acknowledgments should look like, they should be historical and present day truth telling. The individual acknowledging the land should self-locate who they are and where they come from. They should share their personal and professional commitment, action towards and beyond the process of truth and reconciliation. And the person saying the land acknowledgement, I would like to know what they have done and what they continue to do. So, for example, someone might say, you know, I've taken cultural safety training, and that's great, but that cultural safety learning is ongoing, and it's not just a one-time, you know, action. But there are many other actions that I could give examples for. So I really liked hearing Lori about what she does in her home and having conversations with her children. In doing the land acknowledgements, I believe they should also respect Indigenous communities' knowledge and culture. And so overall, they should be authentic and meaningful. So if you don't know the history and present state of Indigenous people, especially in the territory that you live and work on, what I would say is that if you're not going to do it in a good way, then don't do it at all, because it's not going to be meaningful or authentic, and we're not going to believe you as well. And so I've seen some good land acknowledgements out there, but I've also seen some ones where it didn't have any heart or meaning to it. And the other piece about land acknowledgements, don't ask an Indigenous person to help you write your land acknowledgement as well, because then it shows that you are not doing the work. And so I've experienced this in my work as well, where I've had some colleagues ask me to help them write theirs. And then I have to educate them about how inappropriate that was to ask me.
It's Joanna. So today, this focus, our podcast focuses on a palliative approach to care specifically for our Indigenous population. So often we hear that acronym FNIM or UI. So Joanna, can you expand on what each of these letters in the acronym represent?
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, some people might not think it's necessary to go over the terminology, but there are still a lot of people out there that are not aware of the differences of the nations, you know, that are here. So I'd like to start with the FN, which is First Nations, and it refers to the ethnicity of the original inhabitants of Turtle Island or Canada. And First Nations belong to a band or reserve community and have Indian status. For myself, I am a band member of Serpent River First Nation, and I have Indian status. Inuit refers to the ethnicity of people living in the far north of Turtle Island, and Inuk refers to a person. Sometimes, you know, we've seen people make the mistake, say Inuit people. That's an error. We refer to as Inuit. Métis refers to a collective of cultures and ethnic identities that resulted in unions of First Nations people and European settlers. And Métis refers to descendants of those specific historic communities. So a little bit more about me. My last name, Vautour, it's French Canadian. I have a French Canadian father. Some would think that I am Métis because of having a First Nations mother and a French Canadian father, but that's not the case. I am First Nations, and I do not belong to or have any ancestry to Métis families or a historic community. I hope that gives a little bit of context on how the difference between First Nations and Métis. So Indigenous is used to encompass First Nations, Inuit, and Métis. It's also used in national and global contexts. So in using Indigenous for me, depending on the space that I'm in, I might just use the term Indigenous. But if I'm working with a particular community and if they're First Nations, if they're Anishinaabe or if they're Cree, I would identify them specific to how they identify. I know also know that Inuit prefer not to be grouped in under Indigenous. They prefer to be recognized as Inuit. And so lastly, I'll talk a bit about the urban Indigenous. This refers to people who are living in an urban setting. For myself, although I was born and raised in an urban setting, such as Toronto, I never identified as an urban Indigenous person. I always identified as Anishinaabe or First Nation. So with that said, it's important to ask how one would want to be identified as.
Thanks, Joanna, for all that information. That's super helpful, especially for our listeners to understand what each of those terms mean and how to appropriately use them when we're having conversations or even approaching those people to help to service them. So today, yourself and I will be discussing the importance of recognizing those who may identify as First Nations, Inuit, Métis, or Urban Indigenous, and how we can better provide service and care to these individuals living with a life-changing illness and may require a palliative approach to care. The definition from the World Health Organization states that palliative care is an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problem associated with life-threatening illness, through the prevention and relief of suffering by means of early identification and impeccable assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, all physical, psychosocial, and spiritual. Joanna, can you tell us a little bit more about what life-changing illness might mean to someone who does identify as First Nations, Inuit, Métis, or Urban Indigenous?
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. So we have a lot of terms in the healthcare system when talking about illness. And so we hear terms, life-limiting illness, serious illness, chronic illness, advanced illness, terminal illness, progressive illness. What I've learned about using language that could be less intimidating or threatening is using the term life-changing. And I've learned this from my colleague, Dr. Cian Sao. And so when someone is diagnosed with an illness, I would begin that conversation by saying life-changing illness because it can change many aspects of one's life. So I think it's more sensitive to use that language. And I think it's more sensitive approach when talking about serious illness conversations to recognize that this diagnosis can be life-changing for them.
Absolutely. Life-changing is a much or a less harsh word for sure when dealing with this population, having those really crucial serious illness conversations. I know in our communities, the medicine wheel plays a vital role in our life cycle. So can you elaborate a little bit more on what the circle represents?
All right. So again, I just wanted to say, you know, that what I'm sharing is from what I've been taught from, you know, my community and others around me. So there are diverse teachings exist about how the circular teachings of the medicine wheel are represented. So you might see the symbol of a circle where there are four quadrants with the colors yellow, red, black, and white. Sometimes that black color might be blue, a dark blue. So there are different representations about the medicine wheel that we will see. And so in general, the wheel symbolizes the interconnection of many things, such as the self, stages of life, directions, the seasons, the cycles, medicine, and people. And there's probably more teachings in that circular symbol I might not know of as well. So these teachings guide us on how to lead a good life, which Anishinaabe people call Mino Bimadaswim. So if an Indigenous person is seeking this knowledge, they would go to their community elders for these teachings. For a non-Indigenous person, it would be wise to seek this knowledge from the community elders from the territory that they may live and work on. You know, what you might learn from one community might be different from another. And there's no right way or wrong way when we hear these teachings from those communities. We respect their knowledge and their ways of knowing, doing, being, and relating.
So from an Indigenous lens, Joanna, how does the approach used in some First Nations, Inuit, Métis, and urban Indigenous communities differ from that of our Western counterpart?
So I know that we talk about how Indigenous ways of knowing, being, doing, and relating are different from what we see in Western systems, but I want to share where we have the same philosophy and care, and that is palliative care. I share this from my lens as Anishinaabe in my profession in social work and cancer care. Indigenous wellness involves the aspects of the self, which is the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. And when care is involved with someone who is ill, care is also provided for the family. So in psychosocial oncology, it addresses the social, practical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual of the individual and the family. For me, when I came into cancer care and hearing the word psychosocial oncology for the first time, it was a new word for me because my experience working in the urban Indigenous community, we did not use the word psychosocial. And so when I heard this word, I had to ask somebody if they could explain what it means. And when I heard the meaning of it, what came to my mind was the medicine wheel teachings, and that in the way we want to provide care for someone's good life, they both align.
It's very similar to what we use in the more Western world is the domains of care. So again, that includes that person and their family within the center of care. And then it branches out to include that social, practical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual well-being of that patient as well as their family. Joanna, what are some of the barriers our people may encounter when accessing more Western healthcare facilities?
I would say some of those barriers is people wanting to feel safe when they go into the hospital. I'll use as an example, and I know we've heard stories where people haven't felt safe. And when I think about that safety, we hear a lot about cultural safety, and we hear that word, that term, used a lot. What I've learned is that, and what I want to share with you is a quote from Elder Albert MacLeod, and he does quite a bit of work with the Canadian Virtual Hospice. But this quote comes from the Public Health Palliative Care Equity Oriented Care and Structural Vulnerability textbook about public health palliative care. And what Elder Albert MacLeod says, the healthcare system can never be truly safe, as it was not designed by us, and it is not based on our values and beliefs. So all we can ask is for the systems to be safer. And so we can never truly say that we can be safe or have experienced that cultural safety in these settings. All we can hope is providing a culturally safer experience. I can talk a little bit more about some barriers that Indigenous people can experience in the healthcare system. One is feeling safe. The other is about using the medicines that help us. In our teachings and in our creation stories, we were given four main sacred medicines, and those are tobacco, sage, sweetgrass, and cedar. So you might see these symbols also in that medicine wheel. And these medicines were to help us in our well-being. And so for us, it was a natural way of knowing to understand that these medicines and how they help us in our everyday life. So for Western systems, sometimes I would say in Western systems, they don't fully understand our use of these medicines, and that's okay. But what is required is that you respect our wellness approaches, and that when we need the space to use them, we are supported to practice our ways. So I think people would question, like, you know, how is that considered a sacred medicine? And how can that medicine help people in their health and well-being when we know the evidence of tobacco being used recreationally and how it can harm people's bodies? But we use tobacco in a different way. And how we use tobacco is we use tobacco in prayer, and it's using natural tobacco. And that tobacco is often held in our hand, and it's helps us in our prayers to Creator or to God, if that makes more sense for people, if I were to use that language. It's almost like when you pick up the phone and you dial and you call someone. So when you hold that tobacco, it's almost like dialing into Creator to hear my prayers, hear what I'm carrying in my heart, hear what I'm carrying in my mind. And we offer that tobacco to the land or to the water or to a sacred fire. And so when we have that tobacco, we want to use natural tobacco so that we're not putting toxins into the land or the water.
Thanks, Joanna. So are there any other forms of medicine people may use during these periods for, say, symptom management? And if they do, can you tell us a little bit more about them?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit more about some of these medicines, and I gave you an example of how we use tobacco. I do want to add that we would also use tobacco smoked in a pipe as well. And some people will carry a ceremony pipe, and that is just another way of having our prayers sent or heard, you know, from Creator. Other medicines that individuals might want to use is sage and sweetgrass and cedar. I'll talk about sage. Sage, you know, these are all plants that come from the earth, and each of these plants, tobacco, sage, sweetgrass, and cedar, can be burned. And when burned, we know that when things burn, they can give off a scent. Each of these four medicines have a unique scent. And as I talk about them, like, I can smell each one of them, and it makes me smile because naturally it makes me feel good when I smell these medicines. Sage has a strong scent. Some might mistaken it for something else, but for me, it has a really nice calming presence, you know, when it's lit, or even if I just hold it in my hand. Sweetgrass has a very sweet smell, but if it was hanging in a room, not even being, you know, lit or burned, you can smell the scent from that medicine. I'll talk a little bit more about cedar later on, but these medicines all helped us in our well-being. So what I wanted to share with you all is my experience and how these medicines were used in my experience working in cancer care. So I used to navigate cancer services, and then I changed into another role called the Regional Indigenous Cancer Lead for the Toronto Central Regional Indigenous Cancer Program. And one of the pieces of work that I'm really proud of with the team that I work with is that we developed a ceremony bundle toolkit, which provides a pathway for healthcare providers to respond to Indigenous patients and families who want to use these sacred medicines in ceremony in a hospital setting. So in these ceremonies, these four sacred medicines might be used all at once, or maybe it's just one. It's whatever that individual is being called to use that's going to help them in that moment of time. And if anything, any one of these medicines can bring a calming effect to one and give them some clarity about what they're feeling in the moment, or maybe they might have to make a decision. So the Ceremony Bundle Toolkit provides information on what staff, patients, and families need to know in accessing the bundle, but also how they would care for the bundle. It has information about what is in the bundle. So there are several sacred items in that bundle: a hand drum, a rattle, a copper cup, the sacred medicines, and a vessel to hold those medicines if they're lit. It also has information about the staff and hospital responsibility. So for example, we talk about protocols and how we use medicines. There are protocols that talk about if somebody is on their moon cycle or menstruating. There are teachings that we do not handle sacred medicines because in that time we have medicine that is happening inside of our bodies naturally. And so it's about honoring that medicine that is with us in that time. Also, another important protocol is that if someone has used any substances or alcohol, that they do not handle sacred medicines. What I've been taught about, you know, substances and alcohol is that it impairs our body, mind, and spirit. And so we want to be able to use these medicines in a good way. And so if we had used any alcohol, the protocol is 4 days, but sometimes we might be a bit more flexible with that protocol where it would be 1 to 4 days, depending on the situation, for that individual to handle medicine. One thing about the hospital responsibility is that once a year, the hospital has to come to an annual bundle feast, and they have to bring that sacred bundle. So in Toronto, there's about 9 hospitals that have a bundle, and we come together and we bring these bundles together and we feast them and give thanks for the medicine that it has brought to the people. And so that's just an example about the hospital responsibility. And we'll be doing that at the end of the month. And it's a really special time, you know, for all of us to gather. What else could I share about this bundle? It talks about smudging. It talks about traditional use of tobacco in the hospital. So, for example, one could actually smoke tobacco in a pipe in a hospital setting. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But whenever we create space for a patient and family to have ceremony in the hospital, we also have this ceremony advisory poster. And we post this poster outside of the room just to make people aware that a ceremony is taking place so that they can just be mindful of their voices in the hallway so that we do not interrupt the ceremony in progress. And that if people have any questions about the ceremony that's happening, there's a contact information that they can contact our team if they have any questions about it. There's lots that can be shared about supporting Indigenous spiritual care. There's also the Ontario Human Rights Act, which states Indigenous people have a right to practice their ceremonies, in addition to the Smoke-Free Act. It states that when Indigenous residents request an indoor area to use tobacco for traditional Indigenous cultural or spiritual purposes, health facilities such as public hospitals, private hospitals, psychiatric facilities, long-term care homes, homes for special care, community homes, or independent health facilities, that they are to comply with these requests. And so if they do not comply, they may be charged with an offense. And so if convicted, the penalty is a maximum of 4,000 in the case of an individual and a maximum fine of 10,000 in the case of the corporation. So I know this is a lot of information that I shared. I gave a lot of facts, but I think it's important to make people aware, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, that Indigenous people have a right to their spiritual care practices in healthcare settings. And I always like to share this information because a lot of people don't know. So one, I want Indigenous people to know that they have a right to access for their spiritual care in these settings. But I also want non-Indigenous people to know, because if they ever experience a request by an Indigenous person to have ceremony, I want them to have the information so that they can support that individual. And I just want to say, we're not always going to have the answers. And so I think it's important to just even ask the question of that family, what is it that you need me to do to support you with this request?
Thanks, Joanna. That's a lot of information for us to have. And it's amazing that you're able to share your teachings just about those four sacred medicines. And I'm wondering if there's any other forms of medicine people may also use during these periods for symptom management, either in hospital or if they're at home, et cetera, that we should be aware of as healthcare providers going into care for these individuals.
Yeah, thank you. You know, when I hear this question, I think of the many stories from my colleagues and how medicines have helped in that symptom management, not just from the plant medicines, you know, used in smudging, or how drumming has helped them. But we also know that people use traditional medicines that they will drink in the form of a tea. And so we recognize the value of Western and Indigenous knowledge medicine systems, and that some Indigenous people want to use both medicines. And when talking about traditional medicines, how would one access these medicines? So they would go to a medicine person or a healer. Medicine people or healers are individuals who have been mentored by other medicine people or healers to offer this type of care where they can prescribe medicines. They're considered doctors of our community. And so they know what medicines are going to complement or not interfere with other medicines that individual might be taking. So for example, Western, very much like how a Western doctor operates, and wanting to know the patient, know what medications they're taking, know in the ways that they take care of themselves. A medicine person or a healer would approach that individual in the same way, in wanting to get to know them, wanting to know what medicines they're taking for their health and well-being. I think it's important to also say that when working with medicine people or healers, you really want to get to know who they are. You know, some people have known these people all their lives, but if there's somebody who is new and they're just seeing a medicine person or a healer for the first time, you want to get to know that individual. You might even want to ask around and get recommendations from other people who have seen these individuals. You know, it's very much like how we do when we are looking for those healthcare providers in our lives. We want to make sure that they're going to have the skills, the knowledge, the training, the competency to support us in what our needs are. And so for myself and my family and others that I've known have benefited many times from traditional medicine in ways that Western medicine could not help.
Thanks, Joanna. And I'm wondering, how do we honor these helpers, such as the traditional healers, medicine people, elders, or knowledge carriers who we approach to support us in our healthcare services?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Kathleen. And I'm going to go back to tobacco. You know, tobacco is such a significant medicine for us. I've talked about, you know, how we use it in prayer, but we use it in an offering to other individuals. It's not just to Creator, the land or the waters or to those sacred fire. We would offer it into another person in their hand. So if you were to approach maybe an elder or knowledge carrier for their help in sharing teachings, my view is that these individuals have a different role than a medicine person or a healer. That's just my view. And that these individuals carry ancestral knowledge and they share it with others. They also live authentically and live a good life according to our sacred laws, which are truth, humility, respect, love, bravery, courage, honesty, and wisdom. You might have heard these words and them referred to as the seven grandfather teachings. Different types of tobacco are used. So ideally, we want to use tobacco that is natural and not processed in chemicals like the commercial or recreational tobacco. But access to natural tobacco is not always easy for some. For myself, when I'm traveling and if I see that somebody has it, I will often purchase natural tobacco and, you know, have my stock. But sometimes, you know, if we don't have access to that natural tobacco, some people will use pipe tobacco, or they might resort to using processed tobacco. So if you're seeing someone who carries a ceremony pipe or pipe tobacco would be offered. And what we would do is we would get that tobacco, we would sit with it, we would pray with it, we would talk to that tobacco about what is our intention, the help that we are needing. And we could wrap that tobacco in a cloth and tie it. And we want to present it, you know, in a good way. So it's always having good thoughts when we handle that medicine. So depending on the request, can also determine how much tobacco is required in that offering. So in addition to a tobacco offering, we might offer a financial gift, such as an honorarium is provided, and that would mean giving someone cash or a check. We honor their expertise, their time spent traveling, and their time in giving that help. So if you're seeing someone in your own time, you can also discuss what is acceptable to that elder or healer. Sometimes a program might contract an elder or medicine person to come to their organization, spend a day in their community, and see members of the community. And so if they've contracted an elder or medicine person to come in, they would probably give them an honorarium for the day. And so in that case, those community members coming in, they would prepare a tobacco tie to offer to that individual. So it really depends on the situation, on what you would offer to that individual who has the responsibility, the knowledge, the skills, the training, you know, to provide that help.
I think that's a super important point too for us as healthcare providers to realize that there is often that honorarium or gift of tobacco, and organizations are putting forth that effort to have these tobacco ties available for staff to use. So I just think it's great additional information for people listening today to have that. So thank you. Another question that I have is just when providing personal care to someone who may identify as First Nation, Indigenous, Métis, or Urban Indigenous, what are some things that healthcare providers should know, such as maybe around bathing, hair care, and cedar baths?
Okay, so we hear a lot about the importance of Indigenous people and their hair, and this relates to personal care. And we've heard stories where Indigenous people's hair have been cut off. And just last week, I saw a CBC report, a 73-year-old man, a Métis man, he had a foot-long ponytail, and it was cut off without his consent at a Saskatoon hospital. So this man was in for hip surgery, so, you know, why would they cut his hair off? So it was very upsetting for me to hear, you know, that this is still happening after many years, you know, of Indigenous people talking about these experiences and this harm that they've experienced in hospital settings. But I can only imagine, you know, the grief that this man has experienced in having his sacred hair cut off. So the significance of hair will have different meanings for different people. I believe it is part of our spirit. It carries medicine and wisdom from our experiences and our ancestors. It can also symbolize our pride as Anishinaabe people. So when mothers or aunties do someone's hair, it is more than just washing, brushing, and styling. It's a connection happens. And it's an opportunity to connect their spirits and have intimate conversations. And so I want to acknowledge, you know, that men also take care of hair too, whether it's their own or others. They know how to braid their hair. A story I want to share with you, it's with my sister and her son, my nephew. And he has long hair and he's 7 years old and it's never been cut. And he doesn't always want his hair, you know, to be brushed and braided. It takes time and sometimes it hurts, you know, when those tangles are there. But in one of the conversations she had with him when he was 5 years old, she said to him, "Anishinaabe people are proud when they see your long hair." And he replied that his ancestors are proud too. And so you can see how the care of hair and how it can create, you know, those meaningful, I think, moments where, you know, teachings can be shared between those two individuals and, you know, talk about, you know, emotions or talk about what's happening in the world. But there's also, you know, that gentleness and that touch and in that care, you know, that's given to that one who's getting their hair done. That's just one piece about providing personal care to someone. I want to share another story about how personal care is provided in a hospital setting, or it could be a hospice setting. And I shared about, you know, a bundle, and some people will carry a bundle, and in that bundle are sacred items. It could be a feather, a rock, it could be a drum or rattle, maybe a pipe or a blanket, anything that holds significance to that person, that grounds them, and that can be a vessel to connect with creator or the spirit of that item. These items are not to be touched unless given permission by the person carrying them. And I know some individuals would have sacred items with them when they were in a hospital setting or in a hospice setting. And it's important for the individual and family to have conversations with the healthcare team to discuss protocols for respecting these sacred items that are present and that help them in their well-being. So I've seen people have a tobacco tie tied onto the side of their bed. I've seen people a rock with them. So it could be anything of significance to that person. And so for healthcare providers and wanting to get to know what is important to that person is, I like this question that I've learned from Dr. Harvey, and he talks about dignity therapy. And he says, "What do I need to know about you as a person to provide you the best possible care?" And I think that's a really great question because we talk about person-centered care. And so getting to know the person so we can offer that care. And what I've learned from my colleague and friend, Holly Prince, she's expanded on that question. And what she says, what do I need to know about you and your culture to provide you the best possible care? And so that's what I would encourage healthcare providers to say, to get to know who that individual is that they're providing care for.
I love that verbiage, Joanne. I really like, what do I need to know about you and your culture to provide you the best possible care? Because it is that holistic picture that you're looking at that entire individual and everything that encompasses them. So I think it's a really good tip for us to take out of here today. So in speaking to traditions and cultural practices, what are some maybe ceremonies or rituals that people may do at the end of life, whether it's their last year, weeks, or days? So some that I've heard are a naming ceremony, cedar baths, or anything else significant in our culture.
Great. I love talking about ceremonies. So I'm glad you asked this question. Language is so important. And, you know, I know some people will say ceremonies or some will say rituals. For me, I did not grow up with the term rituals. We always said ceremony, so I don't use that word, but I know others do. I have experienced individuals wanting a ceremony at end of life. Sometimes that would be a naming ceremony, which is getting their spirit name. And I shared with you all, my spirit name is Standing Cedar. So receiving one's spirit name, this might occur in one's life at the time of birth, or maybe later on in their life. Someone didn't receive their spirit name, I've seen people request it at end of life. And so that spirit name is a name that we all have, and it's the name that we came here with, and it's always with us. Sometimes we need a person who has the responsibility, the gift to retrieve those spirit names to tell us what that name is. So I know that there are medicine people, healers, elders that are able to do this for others. Another significant ceremony is a cedar bath. Individuals who have been trained to do this work or have a significant relationship with the individual who needs that ceremony will cleanse the body with cedar medicine. And that body is honored for housing the spirit of that individual at end of life. And so I've seen this done. I've also done it as well, performed that cedar bath for someone. And so I've seen that done at end of life, but I've also seen it done in different stages of one's life and not just end of life. I've seen it done for people who need healing from trauma and grief. And this is done by a trained individual who can doctor someone with that cedar medicine. One can also even prepare a cedar bath for themselves as a form of self-care in cleansing the body. So I've done a cedar bath for myself as well. So cedar is boiled with water and it makes like a tea, and it's can be used to drink, but you have to be careful on how much you drink. And it's always just following the direction, you know, of those medicine people, healers around you. But you can prepare that in a tea and use it in a bath. And so I've done this for myself. If I'm feeling drained, you know, from the work that I do, and I just need a cleanse and a reset, found the cedar bath to be very helpful in clearing out, you know, the energy that's I'm holding in my body, in my mind, in my spirit, and my emotions.
Thanks, Joanna, for sharing your stories. So some things that we've heard about are memorial feasts, and in our North Simcoe and Muskoka area, Bannock hosts these with one of the elders, and he invites people to these feasts. Can you tell us a little bit more about what they entail and the significance of them?
Sure. Another ceremony that I really love, and we just had one last week. So there are different names that we'll hear for memorial feasts. I've heard the term ghost feasts, ancestors feasts, And so it's a way for people to honor their loved ones that have passed on or transitioned, you know, to the spirit world. And what happens in my community is that on November 1st, we prepare the favorite foods of our loved ones and make a special plate called a spirit dish. So in preparing those favorite foods of our loved ones, you know, we always want to have good thoughts about that loved one because we're making that food for them. And memories are also going to come up, you know, as we think about them. And so once we have that food prepared, we would, if we're doing it as a community, we would bring that spirit, that food. You know, it could be moose meat or it could be a blueberry pie, and we would bring that to the gathering. And that food would be placed on the table along with all the other food that community has brought together. And you would get a plate and you would get a spoonful of those dishes that were brought, and you would put it on that dish. You would smudge that spirit dish, and then you would offer your prayers to that individual and saying, you know, I'm thinking of you and, you know, I miss you. And you might be thinking about, you know, thank you for, you know, visiting me in my dreams, or I know you're watching over me from where you are, and I want to offer this food to you. So that's just one way we would honor someone through that memorial feast. And so, yes, we do it on November 1st each year, but we can always offer a spirit dish to a loved one whenever we want. And sometimes we might get, you know, a visit through a dream of that loved one and think, you know, I'm really appreciative of that visit. Thank you for visiting me. And we offer that food, and maybe they're wanting that food as well. I've had my grandmother show me cake a few times, and I thought, okay, she wants cake. I'm going to have to make a cake and give her a piece of cake. So with that food, we would offer it to a fire, a sacred fire. It's just a way to, you know, honor them, you know, for the life that they lived, and just honor them for how they continue to love us, you know, from that place that they are in the spirit world with Creator.
Thanks, Joanna. And on that note too, when someone does pass in Indigenous cultures, I've heard a couple of people reference to that person who died by their name, and then it ends in ba. So can you kind of explain why that is added to the end of their name?
Yeah. So when we say ba at the end of someone's name who has passed on or transitioned to the spirit world, again, it's just something that we naturally would just do. And so in thinking about this, I had asked my medicine sister. Her name is Sema Kwe. Her English name is Kathy McLeod Beaver. She's from Alderville First Nation, and she's a really good teacher to me. And what she told me that when we say that, it's to let that spirit know we are thinking of them and that we are not calling them back.
Okay, thank you so much. So for healthcare providers that are listening, what are maybe some local resources that people can get access to maybe have some further education or just read up on journal articles or even just local organizations that can support us?
Sure. I'm a bit biased to the ones that I'm going to share because I do work with them. One of them is Lakehead University, the Center for Education and Research on Aging and Health. And our lead of that work is Holly Prince, and they have many resources that folks can explore. They have a page on Indigenous Peoples' Health and Aging. And if you visit that website, a pop-up box will come up and ask to add your name and your email address. And I encourage you to fill that in because you will receive the newsletter updates about what's happening in palliative care, education, and training. And so they've had some really great speakers share their teachings around palliative care and end of life. There's a lot of resources for caregivers as well. There's so much to say, but I would say take a look at Walking Alongside resources in that section. And take some time to click on those links, see what they have, I can't say enough about how helpful they are for community members to understand the palliative approach to care. Another educational resource is McMaster University. We have an education program called Supporting the Journey Home, Growing the Community Bundle to Care for Those with Serious Illness. And it's an educational program designed for interdisciplinary healthcare providers working in a First Nations community setting. And to be eligible for this program, you must be working in or with First Nations in Ontario. And so just want to acknowledge it was through this education program that I had met Kathleen. And in getting to know each other through this education program, Kathleen is also one of our facilitators of this education. And so part of this education, it was co-designed with healthcare providers working in First Nation communities. We worked with 12 in different parts of Ontario, as well as in different roles in providing care. We would like to say that 11 of those 12 are First Nations. They're members of a First Nation community. And so in facilitating the education, we also have First Nations healthcare providers who deliver the education with us as well. I mentioned the work that I do with the Regional Indigenous Cancer Program in Toronto. You can Google Toronto Central Regional Indigenous Cancer Program and our page will come up. If you're interested in having a copy of the bundle toolkit, the ceremony bundle toolkit, we can certainly share that with you. We only ask that if you're from a different area, because we developed it in Toronto, and if, say, you're in a northern community, and that if you want to use it, we would say for you to share it with those First Nation communities that are in your territory. Look at the resource, discuss if this is something that is needed in your community and what can we learn from this resource and to adapt it to the teachings, the values of those nations around you. And so those are the resources that I want to share with you.
And some of the resources that we specifically have here in North Simcoe Muskoka, Bannock is a great resource. It's the Berea Native Advisory Council. Under that umbrella, they have the Mom Away program. There's also the RVH Indigenous Patient Navigators, who are funded by Ontario Health, as well as the Indigenous Transition Facilitator. And there's also different Indigenous Patient Navigators at our other surrounding hospitals, the only exception being Collingwood General and Marine. And then there's also us here at North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. We do have a resource tab on our website with a bunch of other local First Nations, Indigenous, and Métis resources. There's also the Métis Nation of Ontario and our local First Nations, Inuit, and Métis communities. So Joanna, where can some healthcare providers find education to support caring for these individuals? I know you've discussed a couple of them already through Lakehead and McMaster University. Are there any others that people can take?
Yeah, I would have to say Hospice Palliative Care Ontario. If you go on their website, they also have a section on grief and some modules that you can take. But I would also say they have a really good conference that happens annually in June. And I would have to say in the last 9 years that I have been going, I have seen more Indigenous knowledge being shared at this conference each year. And I would have to say it's probably one of my favorite palliative care conferences to go to. They also have a bursary for First Nations, Inuit, Métis who would like to go to the conference. So you can go on their website, sign up for their newsletter to keep up to date on palliative care resources, as well as the conference and when to apply for the FNIM bursary. Another great resource that I'm also a big fan of and who I also had the privilege to work with is Canadian Virtual Hospice. They have Indigenous cultural safety modules and the Living My Culture videos. everyone working in healthcare has the opportunity to make a positive difference, you know, in working with Indigenous patients and families and improve that patient and family-centered care. So they have cultural safety modules, you know, to help strengthen, you know, your practice in supporting Indigenous peoples. And so in these modules, you'll learn about some of the values and beliefs and views about care and develop the ability to identify barriers to culturally safer care and learn how to address those barriers in your role. And so Canadian Virtual Hospice, what I really like about their work is they work with elders from across Turtle Island in the different areas. In those modules, they're also free online. You can work at your own pace. After completing the modules, you'll get a certificate. I mentioned my colleague and friend, Holly Prince at Lakehead University. She refreshed modules 1, 2, and 3. And I wrote modules 4 and 5 on grief and loss experienced by Indigenous people.
I think the Canadian Virtual Hospice is a great resource. I've watched a couple of their videos, and one video that stuck with me is about walking into that person's home of a community member, of that loved one, et cetera, and just taking in that whole scene, looking with your eyes, what are you seeing, listening, what do you hear, what are the needs of the people, and just feeling with your heart, like, what is it that you feel the need or the draw to in servicing that person at that moment. So I think it's a really, really great resource for people to have. Is there anything else we can do to support the First Nation, Inuit, Métis, or Urban Indigenous people, Joanna?
Yes, I would say I just wanted to go back to what I shared earlier about that question from Dr. Harvey Chachanoff and Holly Prince, and asking that question, what do I need to know about you and your culture to provide you the best possible care? And if you ask this question, you need to follow up with action. Learn about the history and current context of Indigenous people. Know that Indigenous knowledge is sacred, it's powerful. Attend cultural events. They are for everyone. So if you see that there's a powwow happening in the community or a round dance, it's for everyone. And so I would say attend, and you might want to ask around, like, what do I need to know in attending these cultural events? I also want to acknowledge today, November 7th, is also Inuit people. I'm going to say Inuit Day. And so it's a day to celebrate Inuit and, you know, the knowledge and, you know, the culture as well.
Thanks so much, Joanna. Oh, and I do have one last question. So why do some people say Bama Pi versus goodbye?
Yeah, so Bama Pi is a short way of saying see you later. We would say Bamapi Minwak Wabman. And so what that means is I'll see you later. We don't have a word for goodbye. We say see you later, and it could mean that we will see them later here on this earth walk, or we would see them later in the spirit world.
Amazing. So thanks so much, Joanna, for your time and sharing all of your information and knowledge with us. I know everybody that's listening today, they've learned so much. So with that being said, Chimigwech, thank you, and Bamapi.
Right. Well, thank you so much for having me. You know, these were really great questions, and I hope that what I have shared will give people what I have shared. I hope it encourages others to learn more about Indigenous people and the territory, you know, that they live and work in.
Thank you, Joanna and Kathleen, both. Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights on such a deeply important topic. Your expertise and experiences are invaluable in helping us understand the different complexities of a palliative approach to care with a focus on the Indigenous population. We really do appreciate your time and the work you do to support those navigating these life-changing journeys.